Hello and welcome to 107.5 Switch Radio. You're listening to me, Terry Ann, who's normally on a Wednesday from 2 till 5. However, I have made a special addition to Tuesday evenings for Mental Health Awareness Week 2019. You may have heard on Daytime Live that we've been centering all of the conversations we have on air around mental health, and that's exactly what we'll be doing this evening with your help. This evening is a very special phone-in show. We don't often do these, but we thought we'd try something new for Mental Health Awareness Week 2019. So if you want to chat to Compass Support, Papyrus or Aquarius, you can ring us on 0121 288 1075. How memorable is that? The number ends in 1075 and we are 107.5 Switch Radio. Anyway, I'm going to introduce our guests for this evening. They will be answering your questions for the next hour. So first we have Phil Harris from the Compass Support Health and Wellbeing team. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
So we are a wellbeing service. So we're a wellbeing service, and we promote positive wellbeing. So we try and get people back into social circles again, tackle wellbeing issues such as substance signposting into substance misuse organisations. And then if we can't access the support services that we need, we bring services in like Papyrus as well.
Okie dokie, and we have the wonderful Aquarius in. If you guys could tell me your names and what you do.
Yeah, sure. My name's Dan Pack. I work for the Young People's Team. So I have two kind of roles, if you like. The one side of it is working with substance misuse, and the other bit is working with gambling and gaming. So in terms of what I do some face-to-face work with professionals. So obviously I train professionals in terms of signs, symptoms, awareness, and also in terms of how best to engage young people and then to refer into treatment services. And the second side of it is actually going to schools, colleges, that type of thing, and actually then doing workshops with the young people themselves to make them more aware of risks, vulnerability factors in relation to gaming and gambling. And on the other side, I do pretty much the same thing, but in relation to drugs, alcohol, all substances, basically. So that's, in a nutshell, what I do for the time being, yeah.
Okie dokie.
My name's Lisa. I'm a YP practitioner alongside with Dan. I work for the Choices Project, so I work with young people from the ages of 10 to 18 who are affected by another person's alcohol or substance misuse. So we offer one-to-one support, group activities, day trips, events, and then family support as well.
Okie dokie, so that was Aquarius, and if you have any questions for them, you can ring us on 0121 288 1075. But now introducing our last guest, this is Dave, and he's from Papyrus. Hello.
Hi there, Terry Ann. So yes, I'm Dave from the charity Papyrus Prevention of Young Suicide. Now, what I'm doing, my job is I'm a community suicide prevention advisor, which means that I go out into the community and I do loads of awareness raising about young suicide. So I do lots of stalls at events and attend different meetings related to suicide prevention with local authorities. I also deliver loads of training for people who work with young people around recognising the signs that someone may potentially be suicidal, and also how to have these conversations with them about the thoughts that they're having and the services that they can then access. As well as that, as a charity, we run a crisis line called Hopeline UK. Now that is for suicidal young people, and also anyone who is concerned about a potentially suicidal young person, so they can ring that and access some help, advice and support to keep them safe for now until they can access some more targeted professional support through mental health services. And our number for the Hopeline UK is 0800 068 4141.
Okie dokie, so we'll bring it back round to Phil, and just to chat about Compass Support and their role during Mental Health Awareness Week. What are you guys doing for the week, and how have you got Aquarius and Papyrus involved?
Persuasion first of all, just to get them involved. Last year's event was quite successful, and we wanted to sort of build on those foundations that were at And we also did some consultation work with the service users afterwards and said what would benefit them. And they said we would like to keep it very much similar to last year. But again, some of the feedback again was that we'd like more male participants. So this year we've put on a football tournament, or we will be holding a football tournament on Sunday. So that'll be a learning curve for us all. We've got teams like JAG who are recognising mental health in the workplace, DHL are sending across a team, GKN, and hopefully Compass Support will be able to represent with Pioneer and put a strong team in, because we ought to be competitive. But we're just trying to sort of get people to realise it's okay not to be okay, and just recognising the signs and symptoms because of the activities we're putting on. We're trying to educate people out there that there are something that you can look for, and if you don't know anybody, I mean, we all can relate, and we all know somebody who's going through mental health issues, so, yeah.
And how important is it to Compass Support that their service users have access to mental health services?
I think it's possibly the foundations, because even when people come through with employment issues, the anxiety when they first come in, trying to access software that they can't normally use, things like that escalate and then puts a bigger sort of vicious circle in the process. So it just adds some more delays and more barriers. So we try and reduce those barriers. So when people come through a social prescription or have a one-to-one, we'll try and understand more about the individual so that we're not just dropping them into the deep end. We want to understand a bit more about them and put them into a right group that would benefit, as opposed to just they're just bumps on seats essentially when they're coming through. We don't want to see them as that. It's tailoring the service to the individual.
And how often would you say with locals people, how often would you say they get referred to mental health services?
I think it's with the, so take it in court for example, that their referral system is brilliant. They must refer 10 to 15 service users a week. We do a collection maybe on a Tuesday or a Thursday. They'll get that each referral will get a phone call within 5 days, and then we'll take it from there. We're trying to put on more later sort of one-to-one sessions to sort of accommodate for everybody that's in working situations or full-time carers that couldn't get across during the hours that we work. So that's something we're taking into consideration. Sorry, I forgot the question a little bit.
That's all right. So we'll move on to Aquarius, and you guys are based in Birmingham. And you've explained your job roles to me, but what other services do Aquarius provide, and how do they help people with substance abuse?
Well, fortunately, we're talking about mental health, and obviously that's one of our kind of key components for the Young People Services. Part of the model is that we actually have our own CAMS team. For those people who aren't aware, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, but they've now changed to Ford Think in Birmingham. So we're quite fortunate in the fact that we actually have our own psychiatrist attached to the service. Alongside that, we have a nurse alongside there as well. And what that basically does is any young person that comes into our service that has dual diagnosis issues in terms of the substance misuse alongside the mental health, we would deal with that. Now, when we talk about mental health, really speaking, we should be talking about emotional health or well-being. So again, it doesn't just incorporate, clearly, there's a diagnosed mental health condition such as bipolar disorder, as an example. We'd also look at kind of behavioural issues, look at educational issues as well in terms of that young person, why they might not be performing in school. Often, what you tend to find is if they're using substances with a mental health issue, the two go hand in hand quite nicely, if you understand what I'm saying, because if you have an issue with your mental health, clearly you may well be using substances to balance out the day and days with the updates, if that makes sense. So we have access to that, and obviously they can, again, similar to what Phil was saying, we are able to go and see young people pretty much as soon as they referred. We have a 5-day target in terms of that as well. Obviously we have these teams going into defending teams as well. So that's one element of what we do. But in terms of us, what else we're able to do as well, we have a project called the GROW Project as well. Now, it's a bit of a niche project, which might not be suitable for everybody, but the whole purpose behind it is it's a project based in the open air, and the whole purpose is growing fruit and veg. So obviously gardening from a therapeutic perspective, but also having an awareness of and being out in nature and bits and pieces can be quite beneficial in that respect. So that's one element of what we do. Alongside that, as well, I've mentioned we have workers in every single youth fending teams as well. Lisa, who will speak about it in a moment, obviously she's part of the family support team as well. And I don't want to constantly steal too much of her thunder, but essentially we have two kind of like parallel services, if you like, in the family team. So we have a service which is dedicated for those young people affected by parental or familial kind of substance misuse or mental health issues. And then the other side of it is to work with the family members whose children are then affected by their involvement in substance misuse or mental health or gambling and so on and so forth. So that's pretty much, I think, all I'm going to say on what Aquarius do for the time being. I mean, obviously, I've already spoken about the training side, but I think you know, your listeners will be really pleased to hear what Lisa's got to say about her role and what she does, because obviously that's quite helpful to the families.
Okie dokie, so we'll go on to you then, Lisa. Hopefully none of your thunder has been stolen.
No, never. So part of the Choices Project, as Dan was saying, it's about involving the whole family. Now, some young people don't want their family involved, which is absolutely fine, and will just, you know, support themselves. But with the Choices Project, because they're from such a young age, from the age of 10, their families have to kind of be involved, because they have to give consent. So we try as much as we can to involve everyone. And the first thing I do when I go out for an assessment is to go and visit the family home and see the dynamics and see how things work, see what's working well, what needs, you know, the support there to be put in place. Like Dan says, we have Forward Thinking Birmingham at our building. We also have other counsellors as well, so we can get the support really quick. So if I've got a young person that's really struggling but there's a waiting list for mental health support, I can get them in to see a counsellor straight away, which is really helpful for everyone. We also do events. So every year we do the Easter egg hunts we've just had. We do Halloween party. We have a Christmas party. So last year we done a pantomime. So all the volunteers were all dressed up. I was the Wicked Witch. Linda was Mrs. Brown. We had Dorothy. And it was, there's loads of us there. And there's usually about 20 or 30 children that we invite. Everything's completely free. And then there's the day trips as well, which involve the whole family. So, again, they're free. We go to the seaside every year. We go to trips to the zoo. And it's about keeping the family connections and about giving them something that they probably haven't had, because it's not just the mental health, it's the finances, it's the whole package that's affecting the whole family. And a lot of young people have never been outside Birmingham, probably never been outside their own area with the mum and dad. So it's about giving the whole family that experience of what else is out there and how they can move forward with their lives.
Okay, so we'll go on to Dave from Papyrus, and I'll just swing that microphone there. Now over to you, and just talk a little bit about the wider role that Papyrus have in preventing young suicide.
Well, I think one of the keys to preventing young suicide, and of course suicide in general, is allowing people to know that it's okay to experience these feelings, but also at the same time to know that they can talk to someone about it, be it even their friend down the pub or their partner, and just have that conversation without any judgment. Because suicide's so stigmatised still in society, a lot of people feel that they can't have that conversation, and so they bottle it all in. And then, as we all know, if you just bottle your emotions in, it's not a healthy way of dealing with things, and so things tend to get to a head rather than actually being dealt with in a productive, safe and sensible way. So part of the work that we do is raising a lot of awareness around the issue as suicide, and how it is a community issue as well. It affects all of us. I bet most people listening have had some kind of contact with suicide, be it someone that they know, or at the very least someone that they've heard of and, you know, like off the telly or what have you. And I think we can all recognise that suicide is a big issue, and I think some of the stigma around it is gradually dissipating, but as a charity we hope to, you know, further remove some of that stigma so these conversations can be had and that people feel comfortable to talk about suicide. One of the key things is if you think that someone may potentially be thinking about ending their own life, to feel confident and comfortable to speak to them and ask them, are you feeling suicidal? How are you doing at the moment? And just know that asking that question in itself isn't going to do any harm. It's a common misconception that By asking someone about suicide, you can put that idea into their mind. But that's not true at all. There's so much research in that area. Just by asking someone if they're suicidal, you can't put that thought there if it's not already there. So to ask someone if they're feeling suicidal and the answer's no, there's no harm being done, nothing's been lost, and they know that you're a safe person to talk to if they're ever feeling that way in the future. And of course, that there's nothing to be ashamed of, and conversations can be had. If the answer's yes, that they are feeling that way, then you can be there for them to offer them support, but also help them to access services that perhaps they wouldn't have thought of accessing before, such as in the first instance crisis lines such as our Hopeline UK or the Samaritans. And from there they can get, like I said, more targeted mental health support, perhaps through their GP or other community services that will help them to move past those feelings.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to you and talk to you in a moment, because there's something quite topical that's been in the news today specifically that I'd like to talk to you about. But first off, if you would like to talk to any of our guests today from Compass, Aquarius or Papyrus, you can call, give us a ring at 0121 288 1075. So guys, first question I want to put out to all of you is, how important is it to intervene if you do feel like maybe a friend or a family member is maybe, you know, feeling a bit down and not the best of their mental health?
I think it's really important. Whilst ultimately the issue does belong to them, it's so important to let other people know that you care. And the best way of letting someone know that you care is by asking a question and having the confidence to speak to them about it. So many people, in hindsight, wish they'd ask questions. And that's a really horrible thing to have to live with. And like I said, in terms of suicidal ideation, there's no harm can be done in asking someone if they're feeling that way. And if anything, it's only going to have positive impact and benefits to you, the other person, and ultimately to society as a whole.
I'd like to kind of echo in terms of what Dave's saying there as well, because I think you kind of got to look at it in two perspectives. For me, always, you've got to call your mate if you feel or suspect that something's not quite right. So I suppose if we look at it in reverse, if you were feeling low yourself, I think we'd all want someone else to be able to pick up the phone and give us a call, drop us a text message. And again, there is a particular campaign that's going around on certain social media in terms of, you know, send your mate a text message, send your meme, whatever else it may well be, because we never know when it might well be that we actually need that little kind of pick-me-up, little boost and all the rest of it. And I think in terms of that as well, you know, if we also look from a male perspective as well, the one thing I'd say there as well is, from my perspective of men, we're not particularly good at calling our mates and asking, hey, we are. And yet there's been a lot of publicity in the last few months, in the last 12 months really, where we've seen an increase in young men specifically, and suicide rates have gone up as well. And I think there's a lot of stigma in terms of what they were saying as well about young men not actually wanting to open up and talk about certain things. And I'll give you an example. I've been doing a lot of work in prisons recently with young offenders. One thing you see a lot of in prison as well is a lot of kind of bravado, a lot of kind of a superficiality in terms of you have to keep up a particular front, that even though you're in prison, something, I met a kid there, I can't go into the office details, but this is a young man of 15 who's been given a life sentence. He doesn't know how long he's going to be spending in prison, but he knows he's going to be there for a long, long period of time. We all know that's going to have an impact on his mental health. But for him to be in that particular environment at the age that he's at, he cannot show any weakness. He cannot show any terms of the fact that it's affecting him in that way. And I think we've got to be able to have conversations and actually open up to people and saying, look, it's all right, as Phil said, a right start. It's okay to feel low sometimes. And if you look at certain figures out there, one in three of us at some point of our lives will suffer with depression. Well, that's half of us in the studio today. And I think, you know, when you consider that, you know, if you look at your own families, depending on how large your family is, that could mean that even if there's only three of you, one of you within your family could suffer with depression or any other kind of emotional health aspect at some point in our life. So I think it's something that you've kind of got to kind of, you've got to make the effort, you've got to call your mates. And if you haven't heard of your mate for a while, ask them, how you doing? Drop them a text, let you come knock their door. And the reason why I say that as well is because a good friend of mine, he suffered depression for years, and always used to annoy me when people would say, oh, but Dan, how is such and such and so and so? I was like, yeah, they're fine. When's the last time you phoned them? When's the last time you went and actually saw them? And sometimes I'd feel, okay, if it weren't for me, and I'm not saying it was only just myself, but sometimes you feel, if it wasn't for me, just giving them a text message. And sometimes all it would be, you know, joking, it's our sense of humor, are you still alive? And it steps it back, yeah, I'm still alive, thanks for checking. And that's our sense of humor. But again, even that in itself, sometimes that's all you want. And I think it's a question of being able to say, it's all right, we should be talking about these things. So I would, yeah. That's what I'm going to show on it for the time being, so I don't want to kind of dominate too much, but...
No, that's no problem. I'm going to chat to Phil now, because specifically in Castlevale and surrounding areas, Compass Support are running a campaign called Happy Streets. And a lot of that, oh, he's pulled a shocked face there. Let's see how much he knows about the campaign. And a lot of that, especially this week, has been centred around, you know, checking if your neighbours are okay, and really, you know, making sure that, you know, your elderly neighbours got the shopping in. How important is it that a campaign like Happy Streets continues to run in this area? And how important is it to kind of keep that neighbourly feel in places like Castlevale?
I think it's very important, and it's not just to this area, in other areas. I think it's something that we should be doing like we used to do years ago. I think we're all very impatient because of the kind of lives that we're living now. We're also keen to be on social media. We're all sort of plugging away on things, and I think we're missing the important things. It's the people next door that we take for granted that sometimes do need that extra little bit of help, sort of taking the rubbish out when the weather's bad, because you know what the weather's like around here. As soon as we get a bit of frost, people just don't want to go out. They don't want to do anything. And it's something, just something that can be, it's something so simple, like even just, I think one of the schemes we're trying is a postcard, and just trying to find a little bit more information about your neighbour. And just, I don't know, building relations like you used to. You can, if you go back years ago, people used to talk over the fence to each other, have a good old natter, and I think people would be able to vent, and it sort of built, Castlevale's quite lucky because it has got that community relationship. We're quite fortunate at Compass because we've earned their trust. The customers and the service users that come in, they're quite keen to try some of the new activities that we've got. So I think the Good Neighbour campaign is a great way to see the development of the service.
And what would you say, do you think that has an effect of the mental health of your service users?
Well, a lot of the projects that have come now as a result of the Ageing Better project, which was to tackle social isolation, they've now gone intergenerational. So a lot of the older sort of participants in the projects are passing on key skills to the younger generation, so nothing's being lost. And then the younger generation are learning key skills that then they can share amongst their friends, and it's sort of bridging gaps. So again, it's going back to that Good Neighbour campaign again, and that old sort of mentality where you were, the olders were looking after the youngers and the youngers were looking after the older, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. And Dave?
It sounds like, Phil, what we're doing is partly building support networks amongst the people in the local area, and having a support network is such an important thing when it comes to issues of mental health. Just having those people around you that you, like Duncan was saying, that you can just call on and check in on you. Because mental health is so often overlooked, isn't it, and not really seen on a parity with physical health. And like I say, the support network is key to knowing when somebody is perhaps experiencing a little bit of difficulty and could do with someone checking in on them.
So I'm going to come actually back to you, so I'm going to ring the microphone. So in the news today specifically has been the unfortunate news that a participant in the Jeremy Kyle show had unfortunately committed suicide only 10 days after being on the show. It's also it been in the news recently about the two participants in Love Island who also committed suicide. What I wanted to ask you specifically about was whether you think there is a connection between, you know, the mental health of young people and reality TV, and maybe how young people can kind of not get out of that, but kind of disconnect that relation.
That's a really tricky question to answer, Terri-Anne, really, because, of course, I don't know any of the specifics of any of those cases, especially the first one that you mentioned. In a way, though, it could be seen as a positive thing, because it's people like you asking questions like that about suicide and helping to have conversations about suicide and recognise it as an issue that affects people that perhaps you wouldn't expect it to affect, such as people who do go on Love Island. To look at them, you wouldn't anticipate that they were having issues with their mental health. but people like that do go on to end their lives, much like anyone else can, who's experiencing difficulties with their mental health.
And do you think being in the public eye, obviously there it's quite a big thing, making sure you talk to your mates, but being in the public eye, you can't always kind of have that. Would you say that celebrities or people that are in the public eye are more likely to do something drastic like that?
I think we've all got things in our lives which make things more difficult for us, and perhaps showing what is perceived to be a weakness when you are in the public eye could perhaps negatively impact your career. But I would say that saying that you're struggling with your mental health or having suicidal thoughts, it's not a weakness at all. I think it shows great strength to show vulnerability, because, you know, men and celebrities, we are expected to bottle things up and present a face. You know, a man would be expected to present a different face, say, to a famous model, but there's certain expectations placed upon us by society, and it's really helpful to have discussions around suicide and mental ill health to let people know that men do suffer. And, you know, famous people do suffer with their mental health as well. And there's, you know, there's loads of good campaigns going on at the moment, which are getting people talking about these things. And whilst the, you know, the examples you give, of course, are tragedies, if they can be help to go into the conversation around suicide, hopefully something good can come out of it ultimately.
And for people that are wondering how they talk, how could they, you know, bring this up with their male friend who maybe, you know, have a lot of pride and don't want to mention this? As we've got three males here who are quite open with discussing mental health, how would you guys like people to broach the subject with you?
For me, the key to asking any difficult questions, be they around mental health or suicide, is to be open, honest and direct. So much of what we say can be misinterpreted quite easily, and people are scared to ask difficult questions. In part, say if you're asking someone if they're feeling suicidal, no one wants to hear the answer, yes, I am struggling right now. And so people can often beat around the bush a little bit with it. And by doing that, you're not really getting to the crux of the matter and what someone's struggling with. So being open, honest and, like I say, direct with your questioning, albeit still in a sensitive manner, for me is really important when broaching these difficult topics.
I think it's a really difficult question to answer, but I think perhaps maybe one simple solution would be in relation to what Phil's talking about, which is coming up for the weekend, which is football. There's a new initiative that's actually been started, which is related to football. And again, there's a few high-profile footballers getting involved in it, actually talking about the fact that there are a lot of if you look at Clark Carlisle, which a lot of viewers may have listened to, male have heard of, he's been the chair of the PFA, he's a professional footballer, retired a couple of years ago, very intelligent guy, had a brilliant lifestyle, or apparently that's how it seemed. Tried to commit suicide a couple of years ago, got drunk, drove into a lorry and all the rest of it. So obviously the football and PFA and the Premier League have decided actually maybe need to be having a look at the impact of those that don't make it within the game, but even those that have actually made it to the highest levels, because there is an expectation to perform and all the rest of it. And I think maybe there's a lot of guys out there that love football, and that's the reason why I'm talking about it. So again, the fact that there's a football initiative looking specifically in young men and their mental health, that could be one way of doing it. But I suppose it goes back to what Dave said. It's about actually having that conversation in the first instance, being honest and open with your mates. Because we can be honest and open about lots of other things, but when it comes down to our emotions, we're not. And I think, you know, in terms of what you're saying, that's the best thing you can do. And whether it just be, you know, in terms of, let's watch some football. Oh, and by the way, have you seen about this campaign that the, you know, the football that's going on in the Premier League or whatever? That could be one way of doing it. I don't know.
I think if you know your mates well, that's possibly one of the best tools in terms of trying to understand. Like, we used to deliver a project called Get Healthy, Get Working, and the amount of male provider that was in that room, because it was only a small sort of group, there's a small amount of male participants in the group, it was easy to recognise. And then when they had their breaks and they went off and started playing pool and snooker, they had that distraction. So it wasn't seen as sort of something that was frowned upon because they were still playing pool, they were still doing something that they were good at, and they could hide behind that, and it was a bit of a mask. And the conversations and sort of the views and feelings that were expressed, I think it was acceptable because they were still playing pool, it was in that male sort of environment. And I think it's recognising it, like on RTV News the other day, there was the barbershop, he suffers with, PTSD, and he opened up a barbershop after coming out of the police force, and whilst he's in there, his clients are getting serviced, and they're just openly chatting, and then through that sort of conversation, they'll lead on to sort of how you feel and how, what you do, and it just opens a platform, and I think that's the thing, just recognising a little bit more about what your mates need, and providing a bit of distraction to sort of be a tool to get them to open up.
Thank you so, so much. Your responses are really, really insightful and have definitely got me thinking. As I said, if you do want to talk to our lovely guests today, you can ring us on 0121 288 1075. Now, Aquarius and Papyrus are both charities that work with young people in order to either the prevention of young suicide or to get them out of substance abuse. I want to ask now is kind of a similar question, but for parents that might be listening, and that is, you know, how can you recognize if a young person is going through some tough times right now, especially when they spend most of their time in school or, you know, doing other things?
I think in many ways parents know their kids most, but then in other ways they don't. So they might be picking up little signals around the house, might be leaving things lying around, they're probably staying in bed a lot longer or staying out a lot longer with various gangs or associates. It all depends really. What we always try and do at Aquarius is try and educate the family members, so we educate them about drugs and alcohol and gambling and the signs to look out for, and then what the paraphernalia and what the drugs actually do. We did some courses with family members that Dan ran about drugs, and the one lady there was horrified when she broke down. She was in her 80s, and she suddenly realised that her son wasn't smoking weed in front of her, he was actually smoking crack. And that just completely, she went home and just changed everything, changed all the finances, because this son had bled her dry, basically changed everything what she'd done. And now she says if it wasn't for that training of recognising the paraphernalia and what the drugs actually do, she'd still be in that situation that she'd been in for about 30-40 years. So you know, that's how powerful it is to get that training out to family members. So it's not just about training the staff and then going out training other professionals. The family members and the friends and associates need to know all this as well.
And you said you go through the signs to look out for. What are the signs to look out for in young people?
Well, this is the thing, because you see often people say, well, what's the classic symptoms and signs I'm looking for? And my obvious answer is sometimes there are no signs. A lot depends on how much involvement and interaction you have with your own child day in, day out. But again, sometimes you will never know, because I mean, this is the thing. You know, when you look at certain people prior to them committing suicide, people said, oh, well, he was such a wonderful person, but there was no sign or symptom that obviously he was feeling down or she was feeling a particular way. And that's sometimes the thing. Sometimes we think, okay, so there's got to be a checklist of what I've got to look for. Sometimes it doesn't exist. However, that said as well, in terms of what Lisa was alluding to as well, sometimes you'll find young people as well, if they're suddenly part of a peer group and suddenly they're starting to isolate themselves, whereby they're not having as much contact with their friends or their suddenly spending more time with a particular group of friends, that might be a signal that something is not quite right there as well. Again, one thing we might see there as well, poor appetite, poor sleep. But again, it will often be very simple things that you might not notice. And again, sometimes it might be really extreme things that you're noticing in terms of, for even say, poor hygiene. You know, not, as we said, not getting out of bed till, you know, late in the day. That is a classic sign of depression, but it's not always to do with that. But again, it's about looking at the whole picture as much as anything else, because you see, you know, if a child's refusing to go to school, it might be because they're being bullied, but again, it might be because of one of a number of different reasons as well. Again, clearly we would also say if there is substance misuse going on or criminalised behaviour as well, that could well be a sign that there's something not quite right and could be affecting their mood as well. But again, it's hard to say that these are the key things to look for from young people, to say that if they're suffering with this, that this means there's a dip in their emotional health. What we have to understand, to a lot of young people as well, is when you're going through your teenage years as well, there's going to be, you know, spikes in terms of how, when we're feeling good, when we're feeling down, and that's just part of adolescence. The difficulty is in terms of recognizing the fact of, okay, when it's just normal teenage behavior and when there's been a specific trigger that set a particular pattern of behavior off, if that makes sense. And then you can only get that by being aware fully of what your child is like day to day, week to week, month to month. I'm sure Dave's probably wants to add on to what's that now as well.
Yeah, that's made some really good points there, Dan. There's so many potential signs that someone could be struggling with their mental health or having suicidal thoughts. And you mentioned eating a lot less, but obviously the opposite actually applies as well. Binge eating and gaining a load of weight in a short period of time.
That's right.
Not sleeping much.
Yeah.
Sleeping loads is also a sign. Yeah. So as you say, it's really tough. There's so many potential signs that people can show for their physicality, the thoughts and feelings they express as well. People could be saying things such as, I'm just no good. I don't know why I'm doing this, and it'll all be over soon. But if you're identifying some of these, it could just be teenage behaviour, but it could be something more serious. So the best thing you can possibly do is ask the question. I'm not saying anyone who's got a slightly moody teenager at home should go and immediately assume that they're feeling suicidal. But if it's a pattern of behaviour that's been noticed over a period of time, there's nothing to be lost by asking someone how they're doing and what's going through the mind and what their emotional state's like.
Would you say that's a conversation that's been more frequently had around young people rather than older people? Would you say, like, young people are more comfortable talking about mental health, suicidal thoughts, than older generations?
That's a tough one to answer, and I think perhaps Lisa's got something to say on that.
I think it's really difficult for them, because we assume, because of social media, and they're talking to their mates, and they're talking to this person, that person, all the time, that they're actually saying how they feel. But 9 times out of 10, that is just, that's just a mask. So, I'll have young people saying, well, she's doing so-and-so, and she's going on holiday, and she's doing this, and she's spending money. But they're not. It's all false. So we have to explain that not everything that happens on Facebook, on YouTube, on WhatsApp, on Snapchat, it's not all true. So that takes a bit of time to break that down. But what we do with choices as well is we go into the schools to see the young people, because a lot of the time they don't want to talk in front of the mum and dad, because they don't want to upset them. They don't want to sit there and say, well, actually, I'm cheesed off, I've had enough. My dad's using drugs and my mum's drinking too much alcohol, and they snap at me. And they don't want to break the connection with the mum and dad. And they're worried that they're going to upset them. So we all go into the schools and gain their, get their confidence up, and just empower them to be able to say whatever they want. And with the support of other organisations that we can link into, we can get that support for them. But then it's also difficult talking to the family members who will say, yeah, but the kids don't know. And we have to say, well, but actually they do. They're acting this way because they're frustrated. So you're frustrated because you're drinking too much, because you're depressed. But your kids are frustrated and they're playing up at school, or playing up and pushing the boundaries too much at home, because they're frustrated. And then eventually we can get them all together. And sometimes it doesn't work out. Unfortunately, too much has happened. But we give them the tools to be able to work through the rest of their lives, hopefully.
And you mentioned social media. What sort of role do you think social media plays when it comes to the mental health of young people?
You'd like to answer that one.
I'll start off.
I'm sure there's one.
It's another tough question, Diane.
I'm sorry.
That's a good question.
Making us think tonight. I think social media does get a very bad reputation when it comes to mental health, for, you know, really highly publicised reasons, like instances where people have been had a lot of suggestive imagery pushed towards them, which has caused their mental health to deteriorate and also at times for them to end their own lives. In many ways, social media is like a massive extension of people's everyday lives, be it in the playground, be it in the workplace environment, or their own support groups. And so it is important to recognise that whilst there is this really negative aspect to it, it's also a really good way of accessing support. There's so many groups and forums that people can go on and actually engage with people who are very sympathetic and empathetic to their situation, who they'd never have got chance to meet or interact in their day-to-day geographically centred lives. So, you know, with what it gives with one hand, it takes away with another to an extent. But I think it's unfair to demonise social media entirely, although inevitably that is an aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, again, in terms of social media, the problem is it is a bit of a double-edged sword to the extent, because I think it has the capacity to bring about, you know, so much kind of publicity to certain issues. So, I mean, when you think about it, you know, the minute, say for argument's sake, if Rihanna posted, we only be mindful of the fact that mental health affects so many people, it would suddenly get a wider coverage and people would start talking about it. I suppose the issue is how long people talk about it for, how long it's sustained, and what then changes as a result of doing that. On the flip side as well, there's a lot of research that suggests that social media does impact on a young person's development. And all I'd say is as well, if you look at certain smartphones, and I won't mention the name, but there was a particular developer of one that basically banned his own children from accessing and using a particular electronic device. I'm not going to mention which one it is, but you can probably work out which one, because he was aware of the long-term and medium-term and short-term effects on the adolescent brain development as well. And I think the thing is as well, what always makes me smile is the fact that so many people are on social media platforms and have thousands and thousands of friends, and yet the irony is how much regular daily contact and visual face-to-face contact are they having? And I think, you know, there has to be some kind of, I don't know, insight in terms of what's the long-term effect. Because the problem is, we just don't know. We can assume lots of different things. And this is why I think, like they've said, it's so complex in terms of saying, well, it's this and it's that, it's the other. Yeah, I do think that maybe young people are perhaps maybe too attached to it. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests as well that when you're liking whatever post, it does have the same effect of when you're doing that, of using certain substances in the brain. We do get addicted to the release of dopamine, which is what is released every single time somebody likes our post or our picture or whatever else it may well be. And we know this as well. Dopamine is a prime hormone in our brain. It's released whenever we use substances as well. And the two are linked. But again, I wouldn't say that social media is to blame entirely, because again, there's lots more to it in terms of what affects a young person's emotional health.
Because you're with Aquarius and you deal with substance abuse and addictions, how often do you guys maybe come into contact with people that might have a social media addiction?
Do you know what? So far, I haven't come across it. However, this is the mad thing. Quite a few years ago, I did kind of make a prediction saying that in a few years' time, we will have big problems with energy drinks and social media and all the rest of it. And we did kind of get laughed at a little bit then. But suddenly, we've got a service which looks at young people having issues with gaming, whether it be Fortnite or any Evergame, for that matter. Sorry, I shouldn't name check Fortnite. There may be other games that kids have problems with as well. But you understand what I'm saying, you know? So I think the thing is, we may arrive at a point in the future whereby we do get lots of people. Now, I'm sure I saw a story, and it might be in America, where they said some famous celebrity has checked in to a rehab because they have problems with their social media accounts and all the rest of it. I dare say there will come a time where it's more commonplace we get referrals for social media withdrawals. And the reason why I think this is as well, I did have to laugh. A friend of mine was moaning recently about her 12-year-old daughter and the fact that she refused to give up to her mum her smartphone, and when she did get to him, there was the tantrums and all these kind of associated withdrawal symptoms which you wouldn't ordinarily expect. And again, just to give up your smartphone because mum asked her to sit at the table to eat dinner, maybe it's a disproportionate reaction. So I dare say at some point in the future it may occur, but then again, we have the ability to, as parents, to limit access to social media. So is it as big a problem? We don't know.
Okay, and you spoke about gaming a little bit there. I know that from personal experience, I've gamed a fair bit, and some of the communities can be quite toxic. What can young people do, and also what can parents do to kind of get their children away from the toxic gaming environment?
How long have I got to answer that? Because I think we're running a little bit 15 minutes left, I think. But I did actually get asked this question recently. I think the thing is, it's all about healthy usage of things as well. It's about reward and kind of, what's the word, incentives at the end of the day now. I suppose with all things. It's down to the parent to set the rules and boundaries in every single household at the end of the day. And it's not for me to say that parents should do X, Y, and Z, but I would expect that, again, you know, if you've got a problem with a young person that won't get off their Xbox or their PlayStation, and I have been in this particular academy where the average hours a kid, or most of the kids in this particular school, was spending online or gaming was 9 hours a day. But the reason why the parents permitted it was because whilst they were upstairs in our bedroom, they weren't out on the street doing things they shouldn't have been doing, which they considered negative. But the irony there is, I kind of explained to one of the parents, is, yeah, but once you have an internet connection, the whole world can come into your home via that phone line, so to speak. So it's one of those things, but in terms of how you do it, limit the Wi-Fi. Now, yes, it might mean that your 12-year-old, your 16-year-old kicks off because the Wi-Fi is being switched off and all the rest of it. But parenting isn't meant to be easy, and I know, you know, some parents are disagree with what I'm saying, but it's about where you negotiate. So, okay, yes, you can have access to X, Y, and Z, the tablet, because, again, certain equipment has to be used for schoolwork and all the rest of it. But it's a question of how you manage schoolwork, where they're allowed to play, access to sites as well. Because, again, parents do have the power. And, yes, of course, there's a lot of kids out there that know coding in school, and they get around parental controls. But they can speak to mobile phone providers, they can speak to internet providers, and guest services restricted. So that's one way of doing it. But the thing is, there's lots of different things that you can do, but it's a question of whether or not parents and families want to do them. Because you see, the advice I can offer is quite simple, but it requires consistency. It requires, you know, that persistent approach to doing things over and over again. And the time that we've got, I'm not sure I can necessarily give it justice to the question. I don't know. I mean, anyone else, feel free to chip in.
But I think it's quite, it's very easy, isn't it, for a parent to say, yeah, but it keeps them quiet.
Yeah.
It keeps them quiet and they're out the way, which on the one hand is great at that point in time, but long term it's really going to mess them up. And what they're going to do when they start working, are they going to be, you know, on the factory line doing a 12-hour shift but still doing on the working on the phone as well and playing the games? They're going to get the sack for doing that. So it's about explaining the consequences as well, that, you know, you cannot be on your phone 24/7. And, you know, what are you going to do when you get a job? What are you going to do when you get the sack because you're on your phone and you go to the job centre to sign on and they say, well, what happened? Well, I was on my phone. Mm-hmm. You know, well, you're not entitled to any benefits because that's how it works. That's life. So making that balance.
So I kind of want my kids to have the same kind of relationship that I had with my parents. We didn't have the technology that we had. We had, like, can't name brands, but we had the old school games. And you couldn't play them for hours. You'd get bored. But,
bleep.
Yeah, not that old school. But, again, it's sort of taking an interest and involving them in what you do. And then you can get more of an understanding. Like, we have games nights. They get quite competitive, not from my point of view.
I'm sure.
But I do like to win. But, again, it's that relationship building. You know what they're doing, they know what you're doing, and then again, vice versa. And there's so many problems they share because there's a distraction there. You can ask them how their school day was, and they will tell you more because they're trying to nick some money whilst you go around the board and stuff. I'm not referencing the game, I just thought. But yeah, I think again, it's just sort of like answers.
It's about being a parent, it's about being a family, I think. It's actually about getting involved with the kids, and a lot of parents and families these days don't have that. But then again, what's a traditional family look like? I suppose whether it's time or whatever else. And again, sometimes there's a lot of families out there who don't want to spend time with the kids, and the kids don't want to spend time with their families. So, I don't know. So,
I'm just going to pass over to Dave. He's been itching to say something.
I was going to just echo what the other guys have said, really. Sometimes the easiest solution in the short term isn't the best solution in the longer term, is it? If our children aren't getting that one-on-one human interaction, their mental health inevitably is going to suffer at some point down the line, or at least at the very least their social skills, which we all know are so important for actually progressing through life and leading a full and productive existence.
And when it comes to, oh sorry, were you going to say something?
Apparently you were. I think I've put Phil on the spot now.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll just move that away from you, Phil. And when it comes to toxic online communities, I'm going to carry on talking to you, Dave. Obviously, there's been, you know, quite a lot in the news about cyberbullying and that kind of progressing into in-game. How much does that have an impact on a young person or even an older person's mental health? And how does that kind of link into the work that Papyrus does?
I think inevitably any kind of sustained bullying does impact upon people's mental health, irrespective of their age. And hopefully, one of the key things is that people recognise when a relationship like that, say, is toxic and it isn't having a positive impact on their lives. What will come into that, I hope, is people having conversations with their children and knowing what they're doing online, and for their children to feel comfortable to share with their parents or guardians or whoever what's going on, and to have these open conversations rather than to just go keep everything internalised and for their negative feelings to multiply through the bullying that they're receiving. But it's so important that people know, like I said earlier, that help is out there. Like I said, just like in terms of people if are coming up to mental health crises and are considering suicide because of it, they can access help. I mean, our Hope Line is free and it's open 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. on a weekday, 2 p.m. till 10 p.m. on a weekend and bank holidays, and our professional life assisting caregivers are there to provide help, assistance, support and advice for people to move away from those feelings and to keep them safe for now. And as well as just on the phone, I mean, it can be really daunting to pick up a phone and have a conversation with a stranger, so our services can be accessed by text and email as well.
So coming back to that and the services you all offer, so Dave's just mentioned his, but we'll go round to Phil. On a local level, what services do Compass Support provide for local people who maybe aren't feeling the best of their mental health, maybe they need a bit of extra help?
See, the groups that we formed on the back of Mental Health Awareness Week last year, like the Think Positive group, people again will come in through a referral system, whether they've self-referred or they've been signposted through another organisation. We'll have a one-to-one, talk to them, and then using the groups that are already existing from people who are experiencing mental health issues, because the barriers there that people can recognise, and the support groups, so it's a network that, again, that becomes self-reliant. And then again, when they're advertising their groups, then other places to look for, because the people who are socially isolated, they can relate to, because 6 or 7 months down the line, or sorry, earlier to accessing their Compass Support, they were that socially isolated individual. They didn't want to come out of the house. They wanted to do what they thought was the right thing by staying in the house, because if they were in the house, no one would worry about them, because they thought because they're behind closed doors, they're not a concern. But because they were behind closed doors, they weren't coming out, people were worried about them, so they did have to take that next step. And again, accessing the sanctuary on the first time, it's quite a daunting experience, so occasionally we will come and do home visits if people need it, just to sort of keep them in that comfort zone.
I think it's about having those activities, isn't it, and doing something else to do. Outside Aquarius, I'm part of a community group called the North Birmingham Project. So we have a fishing group on a Friday morning. We have IT, and then we do a family service as well. So that's four of us that have got a whole heap of different experiences around addiction and mental health and family support. And they're all free, you know, and we provide all the equipment, and anyone can come down and join us on a Friday morning by Star City for a bit of fishing. And you'd be amazed what the conversations end up being like, just sitting there on the side of the canal. And you know, but after even just a couple of times visiting us and you get to know everyone and you're having a laugh, that's when you start talking about your problems and your issues.
Because
you're comfortable. And if there's someone there who's either been in a similar situation or just shows that empathy and understanding, that they understand where you're coming from, you'll feel a lot more relaxed and you'll feel safe and secure knowing that you can talk about whatever you want to do.
Yeah. I don't really want to say too much because obviously I think Lisa said it all there really, but I suppose in terms of what we also do from an Aquarius perspective, similar to what Phil was saying as well, we've always been quite responsive and quite flexible in terms of, hey, we see our young people as well. Similarly, we will each week come into the sanctuary. They've always been really beneficial to us in some sense. There's a room there, you can come see the young people. We've come down, we've done like seminary evening groups as well, done a drop-in sessions there as well. We go and see our young people in schools. We go and see them wherever they need to be seen as and when it in the day. And I think that's the thing. It's about having a service that's actually tailored and flexible enough for that young person's needs. And that's all I'd say. Yeah, don't want to say too long. Say too much, sorry, for too long. So yeah, that's all I'll say.
No, that's all right. So thank you all so much for coming in. I think one of the things that's really kind of stemmed from today is that it is just so important to have those open conversations surrounding mental health, suicide, addiction, and also to, you know, maybe chat to somebody that might be socially isolated.